I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Andy Reid was fired on Monday after 14 years as head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles after losing badly to the Giants on Sunday and after a miserable season with 4 wins and 12 losses. The season started tragically for Andy Reid when his son Garrett was found dead from a heroin overdose during training camp. Both Garrett and Reid's other son, Britt, have had drug problems and run-ins with the law. But in spite of the team and the head coach's performance in the last few years, Reid racked up an impressive number of wins in the postseason and managed to take the team to the Super Bowl. Unfortunately, they lost to the New England Patriots, and Reid was blamed for poor clock management. But in spite of losing his job, Andy Reid is already fielding phone calls from other teams looking for a new coach. Well, today on Radio Times, the Andy Reid years and beyond. We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Ray Didinger is a football analyst at Comcast Sports, where he's on air during the Eagles' pre- and post-game shows, writes pieces for CSNPhilly.com. And Ray Didinger, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here, Mark.
Sam Donnellan, also with us, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, a job he's had since 1992. You can also read him at Philly.com. And Sam, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Same here, Marty.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So, Sam, how does Andy Reid's record stack up compared to previous coaches?
Previous Eagles coaches?
Yes.
He's the winningest Eagles coach of all time, but it's not an all-star list. Dick Vermeil was probably the biggest hero prior to him for getting to a Super Bowl, which, of course, Andy did, too, over 14 years. I mean, he's the best coach they've ever had. That said, it's the best of mediocrity.
What kind of a coach? How would you describe him as a coach?
Well, I wouldn't say he's the best coach they ever had.
Who would you
statistically,
say?
I was.
Well, well, no, I would actually. If it depends on if people define it by the modern era. The best coach I've ever had is a guy named Greasy Neal, Earl Greasy Neal, who coached the team in the 1940s. He had 7 consecutive winning seasons, which is still a record for the team. Took them the championship game 3 straight years. Won back-to-back world championships in 1948 and 49. Franchise has only won 3 world championships.
Right.
He won 2 of them.
Right.
And he's now in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. So in terms of, it's a whole different, I recognize it's a whole, it's a long time ago and a whole different era of football. But you can say Andy Reid is the winningest coach in Eagles history because that's a matter of fact. He won the most games. But in terms of the most successful, or in my view, the best coach, it would probably still be Greasy Neal.
Well, that's interesting. Does that mean that there's just been a bunch of lousy coaches in the last couple of decades, Sam?
Well, I mean, he goes back almost to when I got here. You know, you mentioned at the start of the show, 1992. So you have to go really far before that. Now there's a younger, not as versed as Ray, but not as young minded as me, that will talk about Buddy Ryan and how much fun that was. It really depends on your definition of best, you know. But you know, there were a lot of bad coaches in that stretch too that you can't even name. And Andy Reid, certainly the duration and the amount of 10 win seasons in a more competitive NFL with a lot of odd formations and such, you know, he's definitely deserves to be considered well in retrospect.
Well, let me ask you why, and this is to you, Ray, why he was fired. I mean, the protocol, I know there were a bunch of head coaches that were fired as well. What is the etiquette of getting rid of a coach? Do coaches not resign or they stay on and then the owner has to fire them?
No, sometimes coaches will resign. I mean, Dick Vermeil resigned. Dick Vermeil, after the 1982 season, was very popular in Philadelphia still. He was the first coach that took his Eagles to the Super Bowl. But Dick reached the point after the 82 season where he was just emotionally shot. I mean, he was the first person that really introduced the term burnout to sports. We now use the term all the time. But Dick actually said it off the top of his head at his press conference. He said, "I'm just burnt out."
Well, and he was the definition of burnout.
And he was.
Huh?
He was the very definition of it. And it was not a cop-out. It was not an excuse. And there was nothing behind the scenes that they were just trying to find a graceful way to exit. I mean, the owner wanted to keep him desperately. But Dick just said, emotionally, for me, my family, everybody, I have to step down. Mm. And he did. And when he resigned then, he was out of football for 14 years doing television and motivational speaking and everything, to the point where I think no one ever thought he would come back. And then when he made the announcement that he was coming back to coach the Rams, sort of took a lot of people, including me, by surprise. And then he came back and had a tremendous second chapter in his career when he went to the Rams, took over a terrible team, rebuilt them, went on and won us, and finally won his Super Bowl.
Why was Andy Reid fired, Sam?
Mediocrity, to go back to that word. I think the substructure that he had succeeded with had eroded over time, too, where people had taken other jobs other places. There was a fallout, apparently, between Jeffrey Lurie and Joe Banner. You know, their drafts, I mean, it's a point that we're always debating because you have to wait for so many years to really value a draft, but their last three or four drafts, I would say, are, you know, mediocre would be a kind word.
But we're also reading that he's had several interviews already, and as I said to you before, and I'm, you know, I'm not a big football I like football, but I'm not a skilled analyst, as you are. But so you have several losing seasons. You get fired, and within hours, you have a job interview. Yeah. How is that possible?
Well, it gets back to your original question about where he stacks up with Eagles coaches, where he stacks up with the coaches of these other organizations too.
Really?
I mean, it's hard to win in the NFL, and if he's been to the NFC Championship, I think, five times. Yeah, he's only won one of them, but for a lot of these organizations, they take that. And frankly, before he got here, if you said that to an Eagles fan, they'd take that too.
Wow. Is that how you see it, Ray?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. You know, you have the problem that he had in Philadelphia was, and what ultimately got the fans to the point where they felt there had to be a change here, was he couldn't win a Super Bowl. They knew that he could build you to a certain point. They knew he could get you to the playoffs. They knew he could get you in there. But they felt like he wasn't a guy that was finally going to win the Super Bowl. Well, there are other cities around the National Football League where just getting to the playoffs looks like a pretty good accomplishment. So, I mean, there are places like Kansas City and there are places like Arizona that have had a long, long period where they haven't even gotten a sniff of the postseason. So if Andy Reid just delivers them to the postseason, if he can win 10, 11 games a year, get them in the tournament every year, that to them is they'll sign on for that right now. Now maybe 4 or 5 years down the road they'll start thinking in terms of winning the Super Bowl, but for right now, what Andy Reid has already documented that he can deliver, they're willing to sign on for that.
And didn't he promise that when he came to Philadelphia, a Super Bowl, or wasn't there the tantalizing possibility that the team would win a Super Bowl?
Well, I don't think he ever really promised that he was going to win the Super Bowl. Although his wife Tammy, in one of her first interviews, pointed out the fact that she had already designed the Eagles Super Bowl ring.
Oh, well.
So she offered the promise of a Super Bowl before he did. You know, Andy has never been a guy that was much for promises or predictions. He's a guy that is as bland as the blandest porridge, and I don't think that's ever going to change. But the fact is, and we've said this a couple other times, he did win an awful lot of games, and what he did in short order, I mean, taking over a team that wasn't very good, and in its second year having them in the playoffs, and then in that period from 2000 to 2004-05, I think they were the best team in the NFC, and you could argue for a period there they might have been the best team in the league. And that, to me, when I look back on the Reid years, that's what I think. I think that was their opportunity. They should have won a Super Bowl somewhere in there, because after that Super Bowl, for the remainder of his time, he was really little more than a 500 coach.
What was he like to cover?
Oh, torture.
Torture. I mean, was he bland as the kind of porridge that Ray just
described?
Yeah,
you know, I was thinking walking in here, what a great book this season would be through his eyes, but you'll never get that book. I mean,
because he wouldn't.
He doesn't recognize, you know, he can give some lip service because the owner got into his head a little bit in the off season, but he doesn't recognize our need to know. He can talk about the fans all he wants. He does not recognize the conduit between the media and the fans. And as much as fans like to yell at media and call us names, which they should, they do get mad at a coach or anybody who mummies up on them for a long period of time. They do intrinsically at least recognize the conduit job of the media.
How though? What was his relationship like with his players? Was it different?
No, I think they loved him for the most part. I'm still trying to figure out, and Ray might address this, whether he was, you know, the kind principal or whether he got into people's shorts behind the scenes. But he took the bullets. I mean, part of why we didn't like him was he would never say, yeah, you know, those cornerbacks left that guy wide open. That wasn't a professional play. He wouldn't say that. While everybody in the stadium knew that's exactly what happened.
You want to add to that, Ray?
I think that's pretty much the way it was. I mean, the players really liked the fact that he never embarrassed them publicly. He never singled out a player for blame. After the worst of performances, if you came in and demanded answers, he wouldn't give you an answer, number one, and he certainly would always say his answer was always, well, it's my responsibility. Right. I have to do a better job. So he defended the players. He was the player's ultimate deflector of blame, which if you're a player, you like right. that. I mean, the last thing you want after a bad game is having the coach go out and tell the world it was your fault. And Andy would never do that. I'm sure he'll never do that. It's just not in his nature. It was, made it difficult as a reporter, and the fans got very frustrated. And after 14 years, the I'll take ultimate responsibility thing really got old. But that's his way of doing things. And it does generate player loyalty, there's no doubt.
But is there any evidence that behind closed doors he might be, you know, reaming out some of these players for poor performance?
Interesting. There was somewhat of a personality change over the last 2 years, and certainly this year, in terms of firing people, replacing people, not giving people second and third and fourth chances. I mean, there was a stubbornness to him for most of his tenure, I would argue, that undid him in the long run, because he wouldn't change when the fans were saying, you know, give the running back the ball more. He had his way, his system. He was somewhat tunnel visioned at times, which I think got in the way of his clock management, a famous criticism of him. Yes. But over the last year and a half or whatever, he did, not verbally, but certainly by his actions, threw people under the bus, including his best friend / defensive coordinator that he had promoted to that spot.
What do you think about Ray?
Yeah, he did. There was one occasion this year where, and it sort of came out that he pulled, after the Dallas game, he pulled the two cornerbacks, Nnamdi Asamoah and Dominique Rodgers-Cromartie, into his office and reamed them out. Mm-hmm. I mean, now after the game, everybody had seen the way they had played, and they had shied away from tackles, and they had basically stood up and let guys walk into the end zone. I mean, when you watched it with your naked eye and then you watched it on film, it was embarrassing the way they played. I mean, they just didn't want to hit anybody. They just looked like they didn't want to get their uniform dirty. They didn't care anymore. And so after that game, you know, Reed was asked about the effort of your players, and he said, no, I was satisfied with the effort. He didn't identify them, but he had to know. And that week, he called both of those guys in, and behind closed doors, told them what everybody else knew, which was that was an unprofessional performance on your part, and you're both accomplished players, you've both been to the Pro Bowl, you're going to have to do better than that. And for the short term, the next couple of weeks, both of them came out and played better, significantly better. But that's the exception. Yeah. I mean, he's not a guy that's a hard-driving guy. He was earlier in his tenure. I mean, one of the first things he did when he was the coach of the team was one of the guys had left the team and then come back. And Reed made a very public show of making the guy push a blocking sled up and down the field on the hottest day. And he made him do it in front of everybody. That's a real. I didn't like it. To me, it was a high school kind of thing to do. I mean, and then he cut the guy the next day after making him do that. Then he released him the next day. My point was, in professional football, you know, that's something you do to a kid in high school. Right. In professional football, the way you get through to guys is you cut them. You take their paycheck away. And he finally did that. So I said, if you're going to do that, you didn't really have to do the blocking sled thing. So there was a different Andy Reid then. There was a tougher, harder-edged guy then. I do think he got softer as he went along.
Well, we are talking about Andy Reid. He got fired on Monday as head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles after 14 years in the city, talking with Ray Didinger and Sam Donnellan, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Coming to PBS and Masterpiece, the season premiere of Downton Abbey.
Downton still stands and the Crawleys are still in it.
They have wealth.
Nothing succeeds like excess.
Privilege.
I would do anything for this family.
They have everything.
It's the stuff of dreams.
To lose.
I'll make him sorry.
Everyone said we couldn't lose.
Don't you see what this means?
Oh my God.
The Emmy-winning blockbuster returns. Downton Abbey,
Sunday at 9 on WHYY-TV.
Next time on America Abroad, the recent death of Christopher Stevens, American ambassador to Libya, shocked the American public. The groups behind these attacks, and others like them, are changing the face of extremist Islam from Libya to Nigeria and beyond. Islamism in Africa on the next America Abroad from Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 11 on WHYY.
Members of the Grammy-winning band Ozo Motley are taking a break from talking about tough issues like immigration and gang violence in their music. They're turning to kid-friendly tunes about things like trees and staying physically fit.
I think responsibility is the new cool.
Ozo Motley presents Ozo Kids next time on Tell Me More.
We exercise every single day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We run, we walk,
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Yes, we are talking about sports. Yes, we are talking about the Philadelphia Eagles and the fact that the head coach, Andy Reid, was fired on Monday after 14 years with the team, an up-and-down record, and also some tragedy that he had to deal with. And again, we're talking with Ray Didinger, football analyst at Comcast Sports, writes pieces for CSNPhilly.com. Also with us, Sam Donnellan, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. You can also read him at philly.com. And again, we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I posted something on our Facebook yesterday. We got a lot of response. We want to hear from our listeners as well. Sam, let me talk about his children. And he had problems. They had problems with the law, Garrett and Britt. They were arrested. I think with one child, there was a question about some guns that were found in a car, mm-hmm. drug problems, went to prison. Then earlier this year, the very end of August, his son Garrett was found dead at the Eagles camp of a heroin overdose. What impact do you think that tragic death of his son and even his son's problems had on Andy Reid as a coach?
Well, if you look at the record, you'd say significant. If you listened to him, you would think none at all. And that's what I said about it would be a great book if it wasn't being written by him. I mean, it's an amazing chapter in the life of a coach. What I find startling, you know, as a parent of three, is you've got your job and you've got your life.
Exactly.
And the idea that after the arrests that he continued on and, you know, didn't miss a meeting, so to speak, and then this summer being able to come right back, you know, 2 days later, part of it, I'm amazed at the man, and the other part is like, you know, what are you thinking, dude?
What about for you, Ray?
Much the same. When the two boys were arrested initially, which goes back a couple of years now, he took a leave of absence, which was a period of about 4 months or so, and it was in the off season. So there was the draft and that kind of stuff. But he continued to work at home, but he didn't have to come in the office. And at that time, Jeffrey Lurie and Joe Banner, who were running the team, really made it very open-ended with him. Look, you know, take as much time as you need. And you know what? If you need to take a year off, you need to step away, do what you have to do first. I mean, they gave him that option. Yeah. And he never took them up on it other than, like I said, I think 4 or 5 months, and then he was back. And once he was back, he was back.
Right.
And it's a very hard thing for us who are covering the team to try and draw an opinion on what's right and what's wrong. I mean, everybody has to have their own idea of parenting, and everybody has to have their own idea of how they go about living their lives. My feeling was, if it were me, if I were in this position, you know, football isn't that important. I mean, it's my livelihood, but it's not my life. And I would have said, you know what? I'm going to step away. For at least a year, I need to spend time with my family and finally spend time in my own house and get my own house in order. And then, if that all comes together, you know, then I'll think about coming back to football. And he could have always had the opportunity, whether it be here or somewhere else. I mean, you see now, I mean, teams are lining up to interview mm-hmm. him now. Yeah. So he could have resumed his career at any point. But he is cut from the cloth of a football coach, which is unlike anybody else. I mean, these guys are so driven, so focused, they will just go through anything to the point where, like in the case of Dick Vermeil, who I mentioned earlier,
yes.
almost reached the point of a nervous breakdown. That finally had to make him step away. You know, Andy Reid coached on through all this stuff, even the death of his son this year, missed one day of practice, was back the next day. Football coaches aren't like the rest of us. You know, they just yeah. aren't.
He was asked when they were, I think, 4-9 or something, you know, would you resign, or words to that effect. And he was like, I love this job. No, I would never resign. And that part of my uneasiness as the season ended was the guy deserved to be fired, if that makes any sense. I thought the owner letting him finish it out was, you know, painted as noble, but not so noble. The guy really, his bullets, he was out of bullets. He was a shot fighter, and he needed to be relieved because he wasn't, you know, it was against his nature to quit. And I thought they could have let somebody else coach that team for the last 3 or 4 games.
Did he ever talk about his son, Garrett? And no. What was his son doing? I mean, I know that I guess he was working for the team, or certainly was up there while they were having their practice sessions.
He was an assistant with the strength and conditioning coaches. They have two strength and conditioning coaches who run basically the weight room, and Garrett was working as an assistant with them. But he was staying in the dorms with the players. I mean, it was a story that no one really pursued very aggressively because obviously there's a tremendous amount of pain involved there. So everyone, I mean, it was kind of in a way kind of the elephant in the room all season. But I have to tell you that there's, I know there had to be enormous concern up in the NFL office up in New York about having the son of the head coach die of a heroin overdose with a room full of vials and steroids in the dormitory with the players while he has a serving function as part of your strength and conditioning program. Mm-hmm. As much as the NFL has tried to be aggressive about getting steroids out of the sport, I mean, that was a story that had to make everybody at the league office very uncomfortable. And I know Jeff Lurie never talked much about it, but I know the people in the league office must have been talking to Jeff about, you know, what kind of an operation are you running down there?
Exactly.
You know, I mean, what kind of scrutiny is involved down there? How can this be allowed to go on in the dormitory on your property with your players right down the hall?
But, I mean, that sounds like a story worth pursuing. Sam? I'm not saying you should do it. I'm just saying.
No, I think, you keep waiting. I think there was, about 3 weeks ago, you keep waiting for the smoking gun to initiate that pursuit. Almost immediately upon finding out officially that steroids were in the room, there was the counterargument, hey, all these guys are tested. So, you know, if they were going to be taking steroids, wouldn't one of them have gone down over this time period? Which pretty much, I think, diffused any great enterprise or investigative piece. And I'm not sure where you would start with that. You know, I think that ship has sailed to a certain extent. I don't know how you would find anything out there.
What was the relation between Andy Reid and Jeff Lurie, Sam?
Jeff Lurie, very appreciative, I think, almost to the end. I mean, I think that's why he was there for 14 years despite a Super Bowl. We were talking before about Super Bowl promises and stuff. This is the author of the famous gold standard quote that is now, you know, used often to ridicule Jeffrey Lurie. And Andy was his minor, if you will, was his chief minor. He stayed with him. It's interesting to me the argument years ago or several years ago, whether it was McNabb or Reed getting in the way of them getting to a Super Bowl. And at the time, I said, why can't it be both? And I'll stick to that. Why couldn't it have been both? They both had flaws that at times got in the way of that team performing to expectations.
And on display, that's Super Bowl night, yes?
Yeah. I mean, the Super Bowl night kind of crystallized a lot of Andy's shortcomings. And, you know, if people all try and analyze where did it all go wrong for this guy, and I think it's, to me, in my view of it, it's what really happened was the two best things he did when he first got the job was, number one, he assembled a really, really fine coaching staff, guys to work with him. His hires for his initial coaching staff were excellent. And then he used his first draft pick on Donovan McNabb. Those were probably the two best decisions he ever made, was filling out his first staff and then drafting McNabb. I think that things began to change with this franchise when they achieved a certain amount of success. They became a team that had won four in a row and they had been to a Super Bowl. And then other teams began coming in and plucking away his assistant coaches. And as that initial staff began to break up and he began losing guys like Leslie Frazier and Steve Spagnuolo and Ron Rivera and John Harbaugh. And then finally, the biggest one was the death of Jim Johnson.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, when that group of assistants was gone, in almost every case, Andy replaced him with a lesser coach. So at the end, he went from having probably the best coaching staff in the league to what in the last couple of years I think was a rather poor coaching staff. He didn't have guys around him, a group of lieutenants, that were able to help him overcome his own shortcomings in terms of game management, like you mentioned in the Super Bowl.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, the Johnson example is right to the point, because Johnson passes and his assistant, who he had several assistants, very well thought of, like Steve Spagnuolo, going through. His assistant at the time is Sean McDermott. He promotes him, loyalty. I mean, one of the attributes and flaws of Andy Reid is loyalty. And who does he replace him with but yet another one of his assistant coaches at the time? Hmm. In other words, after Jim Johnson, he didn't have a menu or at least trust in more famous named coordinators or maybe more younger bucks on other teams. He went inside, including what most of us consider quite the reach to take your offensive line coach and make him your defensive coordinator.
And that's Sam Donnellan, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. Also with us, Ray Didinger, football analyst at Comcast Sports. And we are talking about football, talking about Andy Reid lost his job on Monday, fired after 14 years with the Philadelphia Eagles. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Someone was telling me a story, and I don't know if it's true or not, that people would drive by Andy Reid's house out in the main line and just yell, run the ball, run the ball, stop passing the ball. Again,
I don't doubt it.
I don't know if that's true or not. What was that? Was that his problem, Ray? He just wanted to throw the ball all the time.
There was nobody in the town that talked about that more than I did. I was a big proponent of that. I felt that his offense was way too heavily skewed towards the pass. I recognize. And anybody that watches pro football now knows that it's really a passing league. But you still do have to be able to run the ball. And I just thought that, especially throughout their time, I mean, to be frank, they've had better running backs than they've had receivers for a good deal of his time here. I mean, you look back on those early years, I mean, he had Deuce Staley, who was a fine back. He had Brian Westbrook, who was a great back. And Carell Buchholder, who was certainly a good back. They were better than any of the receivers he had. And yet, the whole game plan was just about trying to get the ball into the hands of inferior athletes. Well, to me, it didn't make any sense. And there were games where I thought they were a very easy team to prepare for. I thought they were very predictable in their formations. They were very predictable in their play calling. And I think a lot of that had to do with Andy's, a little bit of his stubbornness and being a little too wedded to one philosophy.
Well, and I would think the other teams, I mean, once they figure out your game plan, then they know how to counter it, Sam.
Yeah, I think
it's that predictable.
Earlier on, he had lots of trick plays. We used to wait for them to happen. I didn't see too many of those crazy reverses and such in the latter years. Now, to Ray's point, I think when you're writing about this guy in years to come, you say he trusted his plays more than his players. He had receivers until Terrell Owens. The big hem and haw was, if you're going to run this kind of an offense, you need guys who are going to create separation. I mean, there were all these catchwords over his tenure that got lots of play in the fandom and in the medium. Separation was one that I always remember. You know, you had to look it up. Okay, what's that? But, you know, separation was the receivers weren't fast enough. They weren't deft enough. Terrell opened it up for other receivers. And there was a lot of legitimacy to that. But it's interesting that this pass-happy coach would not, to Ray's point, would not have been drafting like crazy every year the best receiver out there, the tallest receiver out there. Anyway.
Did he have the kind of quarterbacks that could throw accurately and well? If this was the game plan?
No, well, accuracy was never McNabb's forte, nor Vic's, to be honest. I mean, they were in some ways, you look at it, there was – I don't want to say it was illogical, but it didn't make sense in a lot of ways. Here was a coach that wanted to throw the ball on almost every play, and his coordinator, Marty Morningwig, exactly the same thing. Yet you had a quarterback who wasn't particularly accurate, throwing to receivers who were mediocre. Just seemed strange to me, but they were able to. He comes from this, what they call the West Coast offense school of thought, and all of these guys believe so deeply in their system that they believe that they can just draw up plays and scheme ways of moving the ball and making things work with average players. And they so, I think, to a fault. I mean, if the idea of the West Coast offense really stems from the 49ers, I used to argue this with these guys all the time. Part of the reason that the West Coast offense was really successful is because you had Joe Montana and Jerry Rice, who may have been the best who ever played their positions. Right. So don't tell me you can take mediocre players to the same positions and get the same results.
And you had Roger Craig coming out of the backfield. I mean, the touch pass that McNabb could never seem to master negated, even when they had the good running backs, negated some of the effect of the running back because he was catching it at his toes all the time.
But is that why watching an Eagles football game, I have to confess, I haven't watched in a couple of years because it's just too painful. But even when they won, it just felt like they won by the seat of their pants. It never had the kind of fluidity that you see of a really good team.
Yeah, I'm a defense guy, and I know this is a bad thing to be in this modern day of NFL, but Jim Johnson had a couple defenses that probably punched you in the nose a little bit. For the most part, they had the old there's another phrase that we heard a lot, the bend but don't break defense, just give them 3 points rather than 7. It's hard to walk away feeling like your team punched somebody in the nose when they won 24-23 and,
yes.
and you know, the ball, and it was a missed field goal at the end of the game or something like that.
The defense was really the backbone of the team in its really good years. The defense was really good. I mean, if you looked at the average number of points allowed, almost every year they were in the bottom, they were in the top three or four in terms of allowing the fewest points. Typical season, they would allow 17 points a game.
Right. It was a staple.
And so they wouldn't give up points. They were very good at taking the ball away from the other team. They were opportunistic.
Right.
And on the other side of the ball, they were the opposite of what this current team is. They didn't make mistakes. I mean, McNabb, for whatever other his faults were, he didn't throw interceptions. He didn't fumble very much. So you had a defense that played very tough every week and consistently. You had an offense that didn't beat itself. Even though they would have these periods of going three and out and not generating much offense, and they would stumble around and not have much offensive flow, I think largely because of the play calling, still at the end of the game, because their defense had kept you in there and they wouldn't make dumb mistakes at the wrong times, they would win these 20 to 17 games that weren't awe-inspiring, but they still went in the W column.
Even though you'd bitten off all your fingernails
while that's exactly what you were talking about.
While they did it. Let me get to, it looks like Joe from Frankfurt to join us. And Joe, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that after Andy Reid got fired 1 week, he's been interviewed for a job the following week, because good coaches will land on their feet, and I think Andy's a good coach. But I think I want to ask Ray what his view was on when you take a coach that's making one-tenth or even a lot less than that than a player, and the coach is telling the player to do something one way, and after a few games or a few seasons, the player sees that that's not working, and he wants to do it his way, and he goes and does it his way. He loses respect for the coach, and maybe that's part of the problem, because the owner is not going to get rid of a million-dollar player on the word of a coach that's making thousands.
I want to know what
you thought about players disrespecting coaches when there's such
for the play calling
difference in the salary.
Yeah, and the salary thrown in. What do you think, Ray?
Well, Andy wasn't making thousands. Andy was making $6 million a year, so Andy was making pretty good money. But I do think the point that Joe makes, he's kind of touching on something that I think is significant. I think the composition of the roster changed significantly in the second half of Andy's tenure. The early years, the good years, the years that this was a really good team, they had a group of guys who were really invested in being Philadelphia Eagles. They were guys that were drafted by this team. They had played together. They grew up together. I'm talking about the Brian Dawkinses, Jeremiah Trotters, Trey Thomas, John Runyon, Brian Westbrook, McNabb. I mean, you had a group of guys there that kind of came in as kids, became Eagles, understood what it meant to be Eagles, and grew into a sense of ownership with the team and a strong emotional alliance with the coach. And they were a good, tight bunch that fought for each other. What happened over time was after those guys retired, after those guys moved on, and the Eagles didn't draft particularly well over a period of years, they suddenly began developing these holes in the roster. And they began to try and fill the holes in the roster by going into free agency and signing this player and signing that player for big money, guys with big names, but came from different organizations with different branding. So then you had, over the last couple of years, you had this odd and uncomfortable and easy kind of mix of guys that were, Arizona Cardinals and Oakland Raiders and Jacksonville Jaguars. And they I often said that their locker room felt more like a bus terminal than a locker room. They were guys that were sharing a space but not a mission. And I think that as a result, they didn't relate to their head coach the same way.
And Joe, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're talking Eagles today on Radio Times. The Philadelphia Eagles, Andy Reid losing his job. And our guests are Sam Donnellan and Ray Dinger. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Intelligence Squared U.S. invites the world's leading thinkers to debate today's most critical issues.
What on earth is so special about football?
Football is America. It is the melting pot.
The amount of money the coaches make is insulting.
The next topic up for debate, ban college football.
Sunday afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
The largest al-Qaeda-held territory in the world is in northern Mali, where Islamic extremists seized control in April and are terrifying the population by performing amputations as punishments. Islamic extremists now have a sanctuary there. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Adam Nossiter, the New York Times West Africa Bureau Chief. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Syria, Iran, the drawdown in Afghanistan. We'll look at the foreign policy and national security challenges facing the country in 2013. Also, what awaits a new Congress and, he hopes, Speaker Boehner. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. As we all know, Andy Reid lost his job on Monday when Eagles owner Jeff Lurie fired the head coach, someone he had hired 14 seasons ago. The team had a pretty miserable year, but the Eagles under Andy Reid won a number of NFC championships, went on to a Super Bowl, which they sadly lost. Reid was named NFL coach three times, I should say NFL coach of the year three times. Sadly, his son Garrett died of a drug overdose, a heroin overdose, at the very beginning of the season this year. We're talking with Ray Didinger and Sam Donnellan about the Andy Reid years, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Sam, they finished up the year with 4 wins and 12 losses, and I'm just trying to imagine, you know, when you're playing on a losing team, which clearly has serious problems, how that becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy every time you go out on the field.
Yeah, to Ray's point is that the players were from other systems, so they, when they become a little insecure because it's not going well for them, they say, well, you know, this system doesn't work for me, or I'm not being coached the same. And when you're basing everything on the success players have from somewhere else rather than from your own place, it's fine to pay Brian Dawkins a lot of money for what he did for your organization. He wears his loyalty on his sleeve. They've got a bunch of their best guys on that team right now made their careers somewhere else, and I think the dynamic is completely different.
What do you think about the decision to hire Michael Vick as quarterback? Was that a good decision?
Controversial. Yeah, they didn't hire him to be the quarterback. They hired him, again, because talent wins football games, and here was some talent sitting out there. I think, you know, if you asked Andy Reid even now, that's why not take a chance? They didn't really care about the legal aspect of it. They were getting a talented player real cheap. Then their job was to figure out what they could do with him. Mm. I don't think they projected that he was going to be their starting quarterback for a couple of years. I think that was an accident built by injury and circumstance.
What do you think, Ray?
I thought that what their original plan for him was to bring him in, make sure that he could get his life back in order. I really do think that Andy made the decision largely because he was into this whole second chances thing, that he felt like what he'd been through with his son, that he wanted to give Vic this opportunity. I think that drove a lot of this decision, to be honest with you. But I think their plan was to bring Vic in, try and hopefully rehabilitate him as a citizen, and get him back, get his legs back under him for a year, and then trade him. I really think their hope was that they could get him cheap for a year, reestablish him as a guy that was a viable NFL commodity, and at the end of the year do as they had done with some other players, would put him on the market, trade him, get a high draft pick from somebody else. And because at that point they really were committed that Kevin Cobb was going to be their quarterback of the future. And I think Vic was a chip that they wanted to bring in and maybe they would have to play with a year later to get a nice return in the draft. Well, as it turned out, you know, Cobb proved to be less than what they thought he was going to be. Vic proved to be more than what they thought he could be, and they made the decision that they committed to Vic, and then the next thing you know, they're giving him a $100 million contract, and this thing has now gone into a whole different trajectory. But I just thought that the decision was never really going to go anywhere. I mean, to me, Mike Vic, I've seen him play from the time he was at Virginia Tech. I saw him in Atlanta. That's what he is. I mean, he's a guy that plays the game a certain way. He plays the game. He's exciting. He makes a lot of big plays. But he's not a guy that's going to ever win any championship. No. He gets hurt too much. You know, he makes too many mistakes. And quarterbacks, if you look around the National Football League, teams that win championships, there are a couple constants. They have quarterbacks that are on the field every week, and they're quarterbacks that don't make mistakes and don't beat themselves. And Mike Vick is not on the field every week, and he makes way too many mistakes. Mm-hmm. Quarterbacks play from the pocket now. Guys that run around, they make nice highlight films, but they don't win championships.
Let me get, looks like Rich from Orland to join us. And Rich, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Ray, I just wanted to follow up on that very topic you just brought up. Reed may be going to Arizona, and I thought I read that the owner of Arizona was still somewhat committed to Kevin Cobb. And here Andy Reed may be going to a club with Kevin Cobb. How does that all play out?
Well,
Rich, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Well, I think what you've got there is that the Arizona Cardinals have made a huge financial commitment to Kevin Cobb. I mean, they're paying him a lot of money. And I think the owner doesn't want to write that off as a loss. So one of the things that might appeal to them about bringing Andy Reid is in is that maybe Andy Reid can be the coach that can salvage Kevin Cobb and get him to playing to the level that will justify the contract. That's part of it. But Andy had a session with the Kansas City Chiefs yesterday that lasted more than 8 hours. And the Kansas City Chiefs apparently have made a very strong pitch to keep Andy, and there's no assurance he's even going to go to Arizona. I think Arizona makes some sense to me. I think the Cobb connection makes some sense to me. Andy's wife, Tammy, is from Arizona. Andy himself spent part of his coaching career at the University of Northern Arizona, which is where the Cardinals have their training camp. I mean, if you're looking for those kinds of connections, they are there in Arizona. But I think that's what I think that's why he's appealing to the Cardinals, is they're still trying to salvage the Kevin Cobb trade and justify the money they're paying him. And they feel that Reed may be the coach that will allow him to play to that potential.
What do you think, Sam?
Well, I mean, to go back to Andy Reed being stubborn, he was his, a couple of years ago, he was his quarterback of the future. If I'm right and Andy's that stubborn, he's thinking, oh yeah, I loved that guy. I'm fixing that guy in a heartbeat. I already got my quarterback in a warm weather situation in a place, as Ray said, that I have roots to. So that makes total sense to me that Kevin Cobb and Andy Reid would be reunited.
And what about this Chip Kelly guy?
You know, he's,
who is he, first of all?
Yes, he was the offensive coordinator at Oregon. He's been the head coach at Oregon. They've had wildly successful seasons. He's credited with reinventing the wheel, so to speak, in terms of an offense that has been emulated by none other than the New England Patriots to some extent, or at least portions of it have been used by the Patriots. He's the latest eye candy.
You're smiling.
He's got no pro experiences. He's 49, I think, which is barely younger than Andy. And I'm kind of a fan of hiring these guys in their 30s now that have all the energy in the world. But and he was at UNH for like forever. You know, if he was this much of a star, shouldn't we have known about him by now?
What do you think, Ray? And then we'll get back to our college.
I think he's a very hot commodity right now because of the offense he's running and because some elements of what he's running up there have now been adopted by some NFL teams successfully. I just look at what he does, and if he tries to bring that offense in toto to the National Football League, if he really just thinks he's going to take his playbook and bring it to the NFL, I think it's going to be a spectacular failure.
Really?
I really do. He's going to have to adapt to the National Football League to play up here. It's a whole different game up here.
And he's in the paper today with Les Bowen's article where Les got him alone on that question. He said, yeah, it's about adjustments. I'm going to have to make adjustments. I mean, it wasn't addressing when I go to the pros. He was saying if I went somewhere, it's all about making adjustments. So I think I do think he gets that.
Is there someone else you think that the Eagles should be looking at?
Oh,
that's on your maybe short list?
Bill O'Brien was an NFL assistant before he performed a miracle in Happy Valley this year. He certainly would be on my list to look at and someone I would be tempted to pay that buyout for because – again, I wish he was in Oklahoma or somewhere that wasn't right down the street. But he's got NFL experience. He knows what it's like to coach NFL-caliber players. And he's now succeeded running his own ship, albeit for a very short amount of time. So I would put him as my number one.
Who's your number one, Ray?
There's some very good NFL assistants, guys that are coaches with teams right now. I think Mike McCoy is a real smart coach out in Denver. The college coach I like a lot is I like Doug Marrone, who's the head coach at Syracuse, who's another guy that has NFL experience and has gone back to college as a head coach. He isn't being talked about a lot, but I think he's a guy that has a lot to offer. It scares me to go out and hire a coach who has no NFL experience. I mean, if a guy's straight out of college, never been to the NFL, I just think it's a big adjustment. If a guy's in college but he has coached in the NFL before, as O'Brien has, as Marone has, as some of these other guys have, I think that's okay. But a guy that has no NFL experience, I think it's a pretty steep learning curve.
Let me get Rich. Thanks for the call. Let's see what Kent from Germantown has to say. And Kent, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Ray, I was just curious if you think that Andy has improved in his two greatest shortcomings, and it's also a source of great frustration for a lot of Eagle fans, and that is basically game day adjustments as the game goes on, and also
clock management. Yeah,
because ever since the Super Bowl, you know, it's... has been a source of contention or it's a sore area, you know, for most Eagle fans, you know, and it's amazing that all these other teams that are trying to bring him in for a interview, they seem to overlook that.
Oh, that's interesting. I appreciate.
Do you think he's made some progress with that?
Kent, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Ray, and then Sam, I'd like to hear from you as well.
Not really. No, I think that's an area where he's still. That's his greatest deficiency. I think Andy, and I've watched him now for a long time. I've watched him during the season. I've watched him in training camp. He's a guy that I think from Monday through Saturday is a very good coach. Yep. He's a guy that works really hard. He prepares. I think he puts together good game plans. He prepares his team well. He's well studied. I think he has a good breakdown on the opponent. I think he puts together a solid game plan. But his biggest problem is on Sunday, once the game begins, if all of that planning goes awry or if the other team has something that he hadn't planned for, his ability to adjust on the fly and shift direction and reposition guys and say, hey, listen, I know what we practiced all week, but it ain't working, fellas. We got to do this. He won't do that. That's where his stubbornness kicks in. Andy has so much belief. And listen, he's had enough success that I understand his own self-confidence. But he's had so much – but he has this deep-seated belief that what he has on his laminated card, the one that he carries around the whole game, he believes that the key to winning the game is on that card.
Yeah.
It's everything that we've worked on this week. And if it's not working during the game at halftime, his belief is, look, we just got to go out and do this better, as opposed to this isn't the answer, let's try something else.
What is it about clock management? And clearly he's gotten some bad marks on bad clock management. What's the key to manage?
Thinking fast. I mean, I think you see it with college basketball coaches, maybe pros too, but you see it in college basketball coaches. It often separates those close games where a guy adjusts very quickly, switches out of a box and one to, you know, whatever. He sees what the other guy is doing to him quicker than the other guy sees what he's. It's a little slower bit of a roll in the NFL,
right.
But one of Andy's resistances was to get somebody to help him do that, and they used Belichick back in the day as a guy who did go and get some help on that, because Bill Belichick was slow to the gun for a while there too. That's not an issue anymore in New England. I think Andy didn't look at that as a fault necessarily. He looked at it as they didn't execute the play or they didn't understand my play.
But time management has become so integral to the game.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is the playbook. You know, it just rolls back to the expanse of this playbook. How often did we see, whether it was McNabb, and it was often McNabb, but Vic, looking to the sidelines as the clock was wearing down, the play clock was wearing down, and not quite getting what was coming in. And I have to believe that's because they don't shorten their playbook as the game goes on, as the game dictates what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Let me get, looks like Jack from Newcastle to join us. And Jack, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, my question here is why doesn't, he's got about a year left on his contract. It'd probably be good for him to take a year sabbatical, just sit back and think of the game, because he's got to improve himself, because what he's doing right now isn't working. And it's really recommended for a lot of people to take time off and rethink their game.
To rethink their game or their strategy, all the things that we've been talking about.
Certainly watch it, because you're so tied up doing all the details, you don't really have time to come up with a different philosophy or study the game that much more. But if you're up in a booth or something watching other people play and learn, I think you'd learn more.
Well, Jack, let me see what Ray Didinger says.
No, if somebody gives me the opportunity to coach, he's going to coach. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's as simple as that. I mean, there's some coaches that when they decide to take that 1 year, 2 year sabbatical and step away, and sometimes I do think it's healthy. Sometimes I do think it helps guys. They'll generally go to the broadcast booth. They'll go to television, and they'll bide their time there where they can kind of stay involved in the game. They can kind of stay in the public consciousness. They can kind of stay around the game, tour the training camps, make a little money, and obviously with less pressure. Mm-hmm.
Well, plus you get to watch.
Yeah, and but so the thing, anybody that's seen Andy knows he doesn't have a future in television. Okay, he's not the next John Madden, so that was not going to happen for him. I mean, he's either going to coach or he's going to step away, and he's not ready to step away. And if you have teams that are already lining up to make him a job offer, and I think they are, then he's going to take it. He wants to coach, and I think there's a little insecurity factor. Mm. There's a feeling that, you know what, if I get out of the mix now this year, who's to say a year from now that there won't be five other guys that'll have moved ahead of me and be the hot candidates? And you know what, maybe it's not going to be as easy for me to get back in.
Let me ask you, Sam, what does it take to win a Super Bowl these days? a small question.
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Marty. I have my plan right here.
Yes, right, exactly.
I think Andy has people skills that we don't see. I would think people skills. CEO, you know, it's used so often in various sports, but I think the best coaches are CEOs. Fran Dunphy said to me years ago, you find out what you're good at and you find out what you're not good at and you hire somebody to do what you're not good at. I think the best coaches are the guys who do that.
Wow.
And that's how you get there. Why do Super Bowl teams get plucked silly of assistants as head coaching jobs is because they do a really nice job.
Do you see it that way? The CEO model?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. It seems that Belichick kind of runs everything in New England, and he runs his defense for sure. But he's always had good offensive coordinators and guys that work with the coach. I mean, that's what Bill O'Brien was from when he was up there. He was the offensive coordinator. Josh McDaniel is now back as the offensive coordinator. But you know what? It's still about the players.
Yeah.
You know, and as great a coach as Belichick is, and he is a great coach, I'm not so sure he'd be as great a coach if he didn't have Tom Brady. You know, I mean, it's still a player's game.
Although he won, 10 or 11 games the year that Brady went down?
Yeah, I mean, Matt Cassel.
I think the CEO thing gets into drafts, too. I mean, when you're the CEO, you're overlooking that, too. They've famously, I think, have done more with a little as the Cowboys did during that long stretch when they had Gil Brandt.
We are out of time, and I have to say our engineer, Kevin Griffin, said, in answer to that question, luck.
Nope.
Well, my thanks to the two of you for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about Eagles and sports and Andy Reid. You can go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Ray Didinger, football analyst at Comcast Sports. He's on air during the Eagles pre- and post-game shows. He writes pieces for CSNPhilly.com. Sam Donnellan, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News and for Philly.com. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times and the person who tells me about sports in this town, and the program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscoyne. Thank you so much for joining us.